WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hey, Pops, give me one of those crazy beers, will you, man?
Man, that was real cool, Gag.
Ex-stadio.
That's fine, old playing old. Oh, we got to get this beer off. I know.
Thank you, Pops.
Pop me, Dad.
I popped you, Dad. Hey, Pops, thumb me, will you, Daddy-o?
Come on.
That's it. Thumb me.
Now, give me some skin and ooze it out. Just nice.
Attaboy.
Ooze it out. Now, elbow us. Just elbow us.
Pops, do you pick up on this jive, man?
What?
Do you pick up on this jive, this crazy music here, man? Did you dig the rebop?
What?
The rebop, Dad. The rebop.
He's a square, man. Don't you get this at all? Boy, you take the brew on the side on the time, and you take this bottle right to be able to drop at the bow. And if you want to, you take the drink and all the bamboo, the bamboo, the beam, the
Young people, who can understand them? Obviously, not the adults in this movie, The Wild One, which starred Marlon Brando as the leader of a motorcycle gang. My guest, Michael Barson, is the author of Teenage Confidential, a new illustrated history of the American teenager and the movies, records, books, and magazines for and about them. Barson is the author of previous books about B-movies and commie scare films. He says teen culture doesn't really begin until about 1940.
It's an interesting thing. Obviously, everyone went through the teen years since the beginning of time, or the beginning of humankind anyway. But those adolescent years, until fairly recently, I think everyone spent more or less as adults in waiting, or adults in training, if you will. For instance, with music, there was no special teen music until, I think, around the time of Frank Sinatra. And frankly, even Sinatra, when he began in the late 30s and into the early 40s, was singing songs that, although teenagers were his most passionate audience for them, they really are indistinguishable from the songs he kept doing throughout his life in terms of the topics and the themes of them. They were generalized for, you know, emotions and romantic experiences and loss and that sort of thing. But even there, where he was perhaps the first teen idol, his music wasn't strictly about teenagers. That all came later, really, in the 1950s.
You mentioned Sinatra and how that was, in some ways, the beginning of music for teenagers. World War II happening at a similar time to Sinatra's early success. What effect do you think that that had on the growth of a population called the teenager, of a culture called the teenager?
Well, I think that the advent of World War II is really what ignited teen culture. I think it had been in the smoldering stage through the late 30s and in 1940. And you could see with somebody like Sinatra, where he was a lightning rod for a teenage audience that was looking for a lightning rod, I think, that something was about to happen. Maybe it was the Depression that had allowed teenagers to spend more time together, perhaps parents weren't watching them as closely. But however it began, World War II just set it off, because once the dads went overseas to fight and the moms were called to work for the war effort and consequently left the home, it was like a Petri dish. You had this group of adolescents who suddenly had all this unsupervised time for the first time, really, in the history of adolescence. And I think that that, over the course of the 5 years that World War II took before we finished with it in 1945, by then the parents came back and they had this subculture in full force ready to greet them.
You have some terrific paperbacks from the 1950s that are kind of like teen exploitation books. Great titles like Rumble in the Housing Project, Go Man Go, The Young Wolves, Run Chico Run, The Thrill Kids, Play It Cool, Teenage Mafia, The Juvies. And, you know, so many of the covers of that period had a kind of tough-looking teenage girl with a really large chest and a really tight-fitting sweater and worn-out blue jeans cuffed, kind of standing with her hands on her hips maybe, and there'd be a bunch of kind of restless, thug-like looking male youths behind her, leering at her. Is that like a standard cover?
Well, this is the bad kid culture. Now, you know, I'm sure, because you, like me, must have begun in what I call the clean teen culture, where we only could hope and pray that someday we would be bad enough to be accepted into the other culture, the JD culture. But it never happened for me.
Were you a nice suburban boy or a nice city boy?
I was a nice suburban boy. Haverhill, Massachusetts, had a population, probably still does, of 40,000. So it was big enough to have a big high school and, you know, stores and all that sort of thing, but small enough that we never really found out what the rest of the world was till we all left it, or at least those of us who did leave it.
Now, what was the allure of the tough teenager, the delinquent, to you as the nice kid growing up in the suburbs?
Well, I think that it's the word rebel. They were able to live out at least for a few hours a day, whether it was just even having the nerve to wear jeans to school. I wouldn't have been able to get out the front door with that on me. But just the idea that you were overtly presenting yourself as one of the rebels in the James Dean or Elvis image, and that meant not only that you looked totally different from adults, which was one of the main goals, but also that girls would be attracted to you, which was perhaps the main goal. Of course, only a certain kind of girl.
Right, who wouldn't be attracted to your father anyways, probably, right?
Or to me. I don't care about my father. To me. No, all we clean teens could attract was other clean teens, and that was no fun.
Well, this leads me to The Wild One, the 1954 film starring Marlon Brando as the head of a motorcycle gang that terrorizes a small town. I don't know if you, obviously you didn't see this film when you were young, because it came out when you were two or three, but when did you first see this film and what impact did it have on you?
Well, actually, this one didn't have a special impact on me because although the biker culture and the rebels without a cause theme were right there and immortalized by Brando as no one else could do, it clearly wasn't about 13 or 14 or 15-year-olds. In fact, Brando was probably about 27 when he made this, and Lee Marvin was in it. He was probably in his 30s, I think. But, you know, I think it was the film that came out the next year, the Rebel Without a Cause, the Nicholas Ray movie with James Dean, that was the one that really was all teen-centric. It was told from the point of view of these alienated teens. James Dean moves to this town, so he's double alienated because he can't even get into the local teen culture being an outsider. Plus, he's completely alienated from his parents. And so he's doubly alienated. And that's something that I think has always been there for somebody going through the adolescent years, this profound sense of alienation. But when you have a whole culture to hang it on, and that means you've got your own music, you've got your own magazines, you've got your own clothes, your fashions, your hairstyles, it really helps instead of just, you know, closing the door to your room and turning out the lights and sobbing.
Yeah, and as you point out, The Wild One in 1954 with Brando helped create the black motorcycle jacket as an important, almost fetish item for biker culture and for teen culture in general, something to aspire to. And, you know, Rebel Without a Cause gave you that sense of, alienation, though it didn't have a rock and roll soundtrack, you point out, but Blackbird Jungle did have one rock and roll record, and that was pretty kind of important in shaping teen culture, too. Talk a little bit about Blackbird Jungle and its use of Rock Around the Clock.
Well, Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets had actually been released in 1954, the same year as The Wild One, and it was a minor pop hit. But what, again, triggered everything a year later was the brilliant person at MGM, whoever it was, who decided to play that song under the titles of the film Blackboard Jungle as it opened with scenes of marauding high school thugs. I mean, these were really thugs, not just kids who were appropriating the badge of a biker and wearing a jacket, a black leather jacket, but these were, you know, criminals in training, basically. You had Vic Morrow, you had Sidney Poitier in one of his first roles as the kids, and the good guy was Glenn Ford, the high school teacher. I think he was an ex-Marine. He's got a crew cut, and he comes in to this urban, it's, you know, New York urban high school, which is just dilapidated, and the kids are ready for mayhem, and through most of the movie commit mayhem until Glenn Ford tames them. So it's not teen-centric that way, because really it was a little too much for most teens to really aspire to. I mean, you didn't want to be in a vocational industrial high school killing each other with switchblades if you had any sense.
My guest is Michael Barson, co-author of the new book Teenage Confidential. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Barson, co-author of the new book Teenage Confidential, an illustrated history of the American teen. I guess it was after the success of films like Rebel Without a Cause and The Wild One, a whole bunch of teen exploitation films come onto the market. And then, you know, a little later you have a lot of rock and roll teen films coming out. What are some of your favorites of the teen exploitation films?
Well, I've always had a fond spot for Invasion of the Saucer Men from 1957, which was one of the many, many, many American International Pictures that were made on a shoestring. They were usually made to be released two at a time, largely for the drive-in movie market. This is a perfect case of movies that were made that they knew no adult was going to see. I mean, this wasn't teens appropriating adult culture. This was pop culture for teenage consumption, period. And in Invasion of the Saucer Men, you have teenagers out in Lover's Lane somewhere, parking and smooching and everything, and these little green men with big heads and bug eyes and razor-like talons land and you start committing mayhem, and it's up to the teenagers to overcome them and save the earth. And there's barely an adult in the entire picture. So in 70 minutes, and for a budget of probably $35, it looked like, you have this, you know, really dumb thing, but it was fun because, again, it was teen-centric, and teenagers saving the world from aliens is even better than adults saving the world from them.
Do you think much about the fact that, for instance, your grandparents were never teenagers, per se? That there's this whole sense of a part of life that they never would have experienced, and your parents kind of barely experienced it because the life of the teenager hadn't quite been established when your parents were young.
I think about it a lot, especially now, having just immersed myself for a year in this. You know, my grandparents, I'm sure from the age of 12, they were probably working. I know both of my grandfathers certainly were, and, you know, one of them was working in a shoe shop his whole life practically. So, yeah, it is kind of poignant to think of that. And I guess I think my parents, you know, were perhaps just right there on the cusp of it. My father was a high school athlete. He had all these track records. And, you know, he probably was a popular guy, you know, sort of a big man on campus in the high school at the time. So I think they were in on some of the teen culture as it dawned in the early 40s.
You devote two pages of Teenage Confidential to what you describe as Toon Tragedies, Death by Adolescence. Tell me about these records and why you've singled them out for to be showcased like this.
Well, I hate to sound like my parents, but, you know, they don't make them like they used to. And this is one thing that was in full bloom in the early 60s when I started listening to the radio. And I swear it just dried up and disappeared. And it was an entire genre of pop music. I won't even call it rock and roll because I'm not sure these songs really qualify as rock and roll. But you had things like Ray Peterson's Tell Laura I Love Her and Mark Dinning's Teen Angel and Patches by Dickie Lee and Jody Reynolds doing Endless Sleep. And it all began right around 1959, 1960, and it went through right to, I guess the end point was the Shangri-Las with Leader of the Pack, where you get this little story which involves somebody getting killed. And it was done as kind of teen opera, I guess. And sometimes it was done for noble reasons. Tell Laura I Love Her. The narrator wants to get his girl a ring, and he doesn't have the money, so he enters a stock car race, and he gets killed in it. But before he dies, with his dying words, he asks somebody to pass on the message, Tell Laura I Love Her. Teen Angel, they're parking, and they're on railroad tracks, unfortunately for them, and they escape in time, but the girl runs back because her ring, for some reason, came off while they were parking, and she tries to retrieve it. The train hits her, and she becomes a teen angel. And, of course, Leader of the Pack, they're, you know, this is really the whole thing in a microcosm. You've got the girl who falls for this bad boy, but this very charismatic bad boy, and her parents break it up because he's a juvenile delinquent and not good enough for her. So in a peak, he roars off on his motorcycle, something I always wanted to do but have yet to try in 46 years of living. And it's a rainy night, and the bike spins out, and he gets killed, and I'll never forget him, the leader of the pack, she sings. The Shangri-Las, incidentally, were teenagers from Queens when they made all those great records, so they were one of the few teen idols that actually were still teens when they became teen idols.
Well, why don't we end with the Shangri-Las singing Leader of the Pack, one of the great death songs. And Michael Barson, thank you very much for talking with us about the history of the teenager and your new book, Teenage Confidential.
Thanks, Terry.
Michael Barson is the author with Stephen Heller of the new book, Teenage Confidential, An Illustrated History of the American Teen.